you were soft and smooth.
The world in a minute.
Morning sanity stations carry no news of the world.
Corporate America owns all the networks.
Freedom of the press is only guaranteed when you own the press.
Communication breakdown. Pause for the message. Wake up. Every station is identification. Global syndication is the shaping of the nation. ABC, Disney, NBC, GE, Murdoch gets Foxy, and with a hint, he owns a pen. The camera, the sword, by a Coke, by a Ford, getting broke, getting bored.
Elvis Presley.
O.J. Simpson, abandoned babies.
Order now.
What we want, what we need, what we want, what we need. But do we even know who plants the seeds? You think the media works for you, but it's a job for them. They're just selling proof. Who owns media? Who does this speak for? Your butt's on the sofa, your mind's at the door, and that's what entertainment's for. It's the drug of the century, the soul penitentiary.
Did you find you lost your virginity at the same time?
Hey there, it's Danny Schechter, your news dissector here on News Dissector Radio, back on the air at PRN.FM after a break for a few weeks. This is the program that I've been doing on this station for a long time, and we're making a bit of a shift this week. We're going to be focusing much more on media issues and giving the program a media focus of the type that you can read on MediaChannel.org, the website that believes as the media watches the world, we can watch the media. And MediaChannel.org has been going since the year 2000. It's a network of media critics and analysts and information and content from all over the world, critiquing media coverage and trying to point to a coverage that really is helpful and informative. And so that's what we're going to be doing now on this program in the weeks ahead. Joining me any minute now will be Skip, who works with me on Media Channel, soon as we can get him on the air. This is our first program, so everything is not totally smooth, but it will be in a minute or two. Our first guest on the new MediaChannel.org News Dissector radio program here on PRM is Professor Matthew Cecil. Did I have the name right?
Cecil,
who is a professor at the Elliott School of Communications at Wichita State University. He's worked as a newspaper editor, a political and legislative reporter, and a press secretary for a gubernatorial campaign. And now he is an author of a new book on J. Edgar Hoover's FBI and the Fourth Estate. It's about the campaign to control the press and the Bureau's image. And in my view, this is extremely relevant and timely. And because the FBI, of course, is still around, but so is a whole intelligence community, which seems to be trying to do the same thing in terms of controlling the press or using the press or avoiding the press to maintain the logic and the bureaucracy and the tremendous budgets that power worldwide surveillance as well as covert spying on Americans in this country as well. So in writing about the past, in a way, this book also foresees the future, the issues that we're covering today. So, Matt, can I call you that?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. Tell me a little bit about how you got interested in writing this sort of history of the FBI and the history of an agency which, you know, was supposed to be dedicated to American ideals and professionalism and scientific methods and became an agency that was feared and challenged because of committing abuses itself against the American people. So joining me, Skip, from MediaChannel.org, are you there as well?
I'm here.
Okay, so now we're ready to rock and roll with Matt Cecil. Matt, tell me a little bit about how you got into this and why you wrote this book.
I got into it many decades ago, actually. As a young person growing up in South Dakota, I stumbled across the story of some bank robbers that robbed a bank in my hometown, and later in college I had a professor who suggested that I request the Freedom of Information file from the FBI on those bank robbers. And I did, and then forgot about it for about a year, and suddenly this gigantic box of 5,000 pages of documents appeared on my doorstep. And, you know, of course, it's like Christmas when those things arrived, and I became very, very interested in this. Later on, of course, as a graduate student, I looked more closely at what the FBI was doing, and ultimately, in my doctoral program, I really started to look at Hoover's FBI as a public relations agency, as an organization that really labored long and hard to try to create an image of itself that helps really disguise the domestic intelligence excesses and illegalities that were going on behind the scenes. So it's been decades that I've been looking at this.
And I have to confess, and I have to acknowledge, and I have to disclose that I have as well. Okay, because years ago in the 70s, I went and wrote the FBI for freedom of information request about what, if anything, they had on me. And what came back was very sanitized, blacked out files that showed that they had been reporting on my student activism at Cornell University in the civil rights movement back in 1961. So I've had this, kind of interest in the FBI ever since, and I'm trying to find out the role that it's playing. And your relation, Ian?
Hopefully none.
Yeah.
That's what I like to hope. But I want to ask Matthew, you talk about it as a domestic intelligence agency and media being used as a mechanism to disguise that. Did that really begin at the inception of the agency under its previous name coming out of the Red Scare? Is that something that really came into focus in the 60s or at least during the Cold War and the McCarthy era?
Well, I think you can trace it back to the Red Scare because, of course, Hoover was in charge of that. Before he was director of the FBI, he was the head of the General Intelligence Division that really coordinated the Palmer raids of the Red Scare. And so that demonstrates that Hoover had this sort of xenophobic, simplistic view of dissent, you know, right from the very beginning of his career in the late 19-teens that he carried forward. But certainly in the first maybe 10 or so years that he was director of the FBI from about 1924 to 1934, there wasn't such a focus on domestic intelligence, and it's really not until later on, and certainly really accelerates in the 1940s when Franklin Roosevelt gave Hoover a limited authorization to begin investigations about American dissent, that Hoover really took off, and of course he took that limited authorization and ran with it, and really what he did, it's very interesting, is he sort of reinstated his General Intelligence Division from the Red Scare era and sort of began or continued updating what they called a custodial detention index of Americans who should be arrested in times of national crisis without trial and imprisoned and essentially taken out of circulation so that their dissent couldn't harm in the eyes of Hoover. The American efforts to overcome a national crisis.
Go ahead. I mean, it seems like this has all the makings of a secret police in America. That, you know, during World War One, there was an attempt here, it seems, to impose censorship and to monitor dissent, which carried on for decades.
Of course, and that was the fear. In the early 1900s, 1908, when the FBI was formed, there was fear that it would become that secret police or that corrupt agency that was, you know, that was subject to the whims of a powerful person. And of course, that's exactly what happened. And there's this remarkable moment in the history of the FBI in 1924 when the Attorney General sat down. The Attorney General, who had been a great outspoken opponent of the Red Scare, sat down with Hoover and somehow chose this man to be, who had led the Palmer raids, he chose this man to be director of the FBI. If you could go back and change one thing in 20th century American history, that might be the thing to change.
But was it fear of Hoover? I mean, did other politicians, members of Congress, other agencies fear that, you know, Hoover's FBI had files on them? You know, did they sense intimidation from the FBI or self-incrimination, you know, mm-hmm. to try to stay on the, quote, good side of this merging Goliath?
Absolutely. And if you think about it for a minute, it didn't really matter whether Hoover had the information on somebody. He sort of let it be known that he might. And really that was enough to exert control. And that includes over people in the media. And that's my focus, of course, is we've got these, it's really another sad story of the media's failure to provide the public with information about certainly in this case, the early days of the national security state. And even more so, it's the story of how many people in the news media actively assisted the FBI to create that alternative message that obscured its real activities. And they did that by producing this flood of stories that fit Hoover's preferred images of the Bureau, and they did it also by attacking critics, including fellow journalists. So journalists became part of that mechanism of intimidation as well over time as Hoover courted them.
Yeah, let's bring it back to the beginning of the agency, though. I mean, my understanding of the history is that basically the FBI was just done by fiat. Congress was adjourned in 1908, at least the predecessor agency, should I clarify. Congress was adjourned in 1908. President Roosevelt went to the Attorney General and said, hey, let's set up this agency. We have the Red Scare going on. There's issues with McKinley. So, and also, there was also, well, let me ask you the question. Was this born out of a real jurisdictional problem between the states and interstate commerce? Or was it really, was it a power grab? And was, did Congress and other people really view it appropriately as such? You were talking about it as, as a private police force subject to one person. And is that really when its interaction with media begins to counter that narrative and legitimize the agency?
I think that it was formed as the result of a need for an investigative agency that would investigate a limited number of federal crimes, particularly involving taxes and things like that. So it was formed, I believe, that Roosevelt and others did
not. We're talking Teddy Roosevelt here, right?
Teddy Roosevelt.
At the beginning,
Teddy Roosevelt. I don't believe he imagined that it could become what it became. There were those who were concerned about that. Absolutely. But I think it's a lot later, after the Red Scare and after Hoover takes over, that he realizes that he has an ongoing crisis of legitimacy because people don't forget those things. And people, you know, it's not, Americans are not suddenly going to become okay with a ton of centralized power in a nation that was formed based on a fear of centralized power.
But
so Hoover had to craft a counter-narrative to try to legitimize his agency in the face of what had become the reality of it as a corrupt, corrupt, scandal-ridden agency when he took it over.
You know, to what degree is that narrative calculated? In other words, was this something that just sort of let's you know find a way to make all this look good to the American people, or actually did they give a lot of thought to how they were going to sell the FBI and America's need for an FBI to the public, and how to use the press to do that?
That's a great question, and I think the answer is it's both. I think that in the early 30s, with the outlaw era, Hoover discovered that he had some, that he was able to have a hook with the news media. He discovered that it was possible for the public to be interested in the exploits of his bureau. At the same time, he knew that he had to be careful about how that story was told. So I think over time, it became a very calculated message. Certainly in the 1930s, it was developed with the help of a couple of journalists, Courtney Riley Cooper and Rex Collier, who helped Hoover create this benign message, this scientific law enforcement message that made people comfortable with this powerful agency. But I do believe that it may have been something of a surprise to Hoover, and certainly around the time of the Dillinger situation, that the FBI became such a subject of public interest. And I think he just took advantage of that.
But clearly, I mean, you know, they recognized that there would be criticism. So how do you anticipate that criticism, and how do you then turn it around to convince the public and convince the press that what you're doing is not only benign, but extremely important, very scientific, very neutral,
absolutely,
very professional?
Right. I think that's the key, is you're trying to both demonstrate responsibility and utility through the messages that you're sending. You want to show that you've been able to do things. The outlaws were the perfect opportunity. Here are, you know, some, I mean, let's be honest, these were not the sharpest knives in the drawer, these people out running around, robbing banks and just sort of raising heck. These were a really nice target for Hoover. These were something where he could show some successes very quickly and very easily. At the same time, there were bigger problems. You know, certainly there was organized crime that Hoover pretended did not exist, because that would have been essentially a loss for him. He wouldn't have been able to solve that problem. So he went out to find things that he could solve, first of all, I think, and the outlaws provided him with that. And then the scientific message really takes the human element out of it. If you use that scientific message in the right way, you can say, well, we do scientific law enforcement. You don't have to worry about the power of the FBI because our science could prove you innocent as easily as it could prove you guilty of a crime. So science is kind of the key to sort of taking the human edge out of this. That plus sort of the early portrayal of Hoover as this sort of avuncular gentleman who was in charge, and he was as interested in our civil liberties as anybody else, that sort of message. So they calculated very carefully a message that would work. And if you, another historian, Richard Gibb Powers, has done incredible work sort of looking at this FBI myth and message that they created and how it was restated in practically every FBI story during the Hoover era.
He was in power for 48 years, Skip.
Yep.
I mean, this guy was a force unto himself in many ways and completely unaccountable, it seems, to others in government. How did he kind of manage to avoid scrutiny by the press during these years?
Well, he had this. There were a couple things going on. I mean, people liked these stories. These stories of FBI heroism were popular. If you're, you know, I was a journalist when I was writing stories. My editors liked stories that readers liked. So you've got this sort of built-in appeal of his agency, and you've got reporters who want to tell those stories and who are desperate enough to do so that they're really willing to accept whatever conditions the FBI placed on their relationship. And we have in the book, you'll see there just story after story of reporters who are willing to give the FBI carte blanche to essentially rewrite their stories. They were willing to not ask certain people questions. They were willing to avoid entire topics because it served them well to be part of Hoover's. They felt like they were part of Hoover's inner circle, and they were able to get these stories. So, you know, the reality of it is that this is kind of a sad story of human weakness among these journalists who either really didn't understand the role of a journalist in society, or more likely who were just willing because of personal ambition and ideology to just do what they had to do to get these stories because they made them successful personally.
Let me ask you, you have the scientific aspect to a degree designed to allay the fears of people who are more politically engaged and worried about a concentrated power. Then you have this great American Robin Hood-esque era of people robbing banks, and that captures popular imagination. You have the advent of television and this newly dubbed bureau. When does the focus really become about shaping the public? When do we get things like Junior G-Men and a message being crafted in all forms of media that really targets the public and captures that imagination and really brings it to the service of both a budgetary priority of this agency and the broader scope of the mission?
I think you can really trace that to the mid-1930s and when Hoover created the Crime Records Division within the FBI. That was essentially a public relations office inside the FBI, and he hired a guy named Lewis Nichols, who had worked in PR for the YMCA and other organizations and was pretty well-versed in pretty sophisticated ideas of how public relations worked. He brought him on, and Nichols became really sort of the enforcer of the message. They created it. They enforced it. This Crime Records Division worked day and night to put forth this very, very clear image of what the FBI was, according to the Bureau. And he was also, again, the enforcer who went after the people who kind of went off message and put them on do not contact lists or sent blind memoranda to other reporters who then wrote nasty things about those critics. So this becomes a very sophisticated public relations operation, really a bureau built for public relations beginning in the mid-1930s with the Crime Records Division.
What I like about your book is that you don't just stop at telling us about Hoover and what he did and what his agency did and didn't do and how they misled people, but you look into the people who are complicit with the FBI. You know, you write here, it's interesting to consider how in a nation so proud of its watchdog press, a high-profile federal agency managed to hide the reality of its activities for so long. How did they do that? I mean, what does this say about our media as well? Because I think that's where, you know, we're a media channel, not a crime channel. What we're trying to look at is how the press, in a sense, gets co-opted or gets compromised and becomes complicit, becomes a tool for power.
It's a very interesting message that still sort of has a lot of coherence today. If you think about it, this process of the FBI becoming what it became, and certainly sort of co-opting the media, speaks to the power of government agencies to dictate the terms of their relationships with friendly journalists. In Hoover's case, you have to say that many of these journalists were, at the very least, negligent in their duty to democracy, and again, at worst, active participants in a massive myth-making campaign.
Let me just follow up. Follow up for a minute, because you're talking about journalists as individuals, mm-hmm. but what about media institutions? It seems like you have quite a few stories here about the FBI going to executives at ABC, mm-hmm. for example, the program about the FBI that Hoover wanted canceled because he got peeved because of some remarks that Frank Reynolds said on ABC News. He wanted to cancel the program at ABC. You know, pled with him to keep the show on the air. And, you know, in other words, media institutions control what they do, not individual journalists mostly.
Mm-hmm. Right. That's true. That's true. And Hoover understood that as well. As you point out in the book, I talk in great deal about the FBI's relationship with its television series and really influencing ABC and Warner Brothers and an individual production company to tell the story exactly as it wanted it to be told. And he did so by threatening to withhold FBI information. You know, they had a hit television show, The FBI, with Ephraim Zimbalist Jr. from 1965 to 1974. So you're talking about a primetime hit television show that is essentially a money-making machine. If you're the president of ABC and J. Edgar Hoover comes to you and is unhappy with the messages that he's seeing in his television show, you're going to listen. Not to mention the fact that he's J. Edgar Hoover and he controls the FBI, which has this massive cache of information and probably something about you if you're the president of ABC or the publisher of the New York Times or whatever you may happen to be. So this larger-than-life figure is able to control at the granular level through working with journalists and at the macro level by controlling these powers in media. He's able to really control his message at every level of the process, and it's a complete disaster for the United States. I mean, I'd be hard-pressed to suggest that there's any one individual that I've studied who had a bigger, longer-lasting, more negative effect on civil liberties in the United States than J. Edgar Hoover.
Well, let me ask you, structurally, you talked about pressure being brought to bear on executives and just the economics of them having a hit TV show and being able to control that message. But structurally, as reporting beats are set up. I work for a company. I work for a media company, newspaper, whatever. My job is to cover the FBI. How does that narrowness inhibit my ability to tell a different narrative or bring to light certain things that would reflect negatively on that agency they wouldn't like? And even now that Hoover's died and currently, is there a way to really get beyond that as our media institutions are structurally set up? With the narrowness of that focus, how can journalists have some independence, or are they just structurally captured by the way their business is constituted?
Well, I agree, and I agree that the beat reporting system lends itself to this kind of immersion in an organization to the point where you essentially have to make a lot of compromises in order to maintain your access to information, right? If you are, it's the old joke in journalism, you know, you're a beat reporter, now go out go out to the Capitol and be independent. Well, you really don't have that option. You're there. You have to sort of manage these relationships in some way. So structurally, there's a problem with that right away to me. If I was to suggest something that would improve media in America tomorrow, it would be to shut down the White House press office and boot all those people out onto the streets, those big-time reporters there making their six figures to listen to what the FBI or what the White House tells them. To me, independent journalism has a lot of potential, and there were perfect examples of that during the Hoover era. A guy like Fred J. Cook, who wrote this incredible piece for The Nation magazine in 1958, where he essentially unmasked everything about the FBI. If you read that piece today, knowing what we know now based on Freedom of Information Act and other historians' work, he was right on target in this piece that he wrote in 1958 as an independent journalist, beholden to them.
You're a historian. You've looked at the past, and this is a really, people, an excellent book, Hoover's FBI and the Fourth Estate, Matthew Sissel. I mean, it's a brilliant analysis because he weaves together not just what the FBI is doing, but how all these people were very complicit in helping the FBI reinforce its view of itself among the American people. But now we're facing a new surveillance crisis, certainly here in America with the Snowden revelations and the recent disclosure of, you know, what happened in those documents from the FBI office in Media, Pennsylvania. A book has come out about that. None of these issues really belong to the past, do they? What's the implications of this history for today?
I think one of the things as an educator, the implication for me is that we don't do a very good job of educating people in media literacy. I fear that Americans don't understand the mainstream media very well. You know, I always use my grandmother as a great example when I talk to students about this. She watches media. She's a wonderful woman. She's kind of ill right now. She's 96 years old.
Wow.
She watches, yeah, God bless her. She watches the media, and she believes it. She believes it. It's the truth. Depending on which channel she's watching, that's the truth for the day. And what we need to do is really educate Americans about what it means to be sent mediated messages, and the fact that who those mediators are and what interests they're serving really matter. I'd like my students to walk out of my classes and go watch the news and think, well, that's a nice take on the news. How else could I see that? And what particular interests are those people bringing to bear?
You're singing our song, Matt, because that's what MediaChannel.org has been doing and is trying to do now, is to encourage more critical takes on the media and understanding how the media can often be a tool of propaganda and a tool to keep people locked up in a view of the world that's often at odds with what's really happening in the world. So I have to say that I really am impressed with this book. I wonder if there might be a selection that we could publish on MediaChannel.org. Your introduction,
sure.
For example, I think it's excellent. Well, I'll drop you a note about that.
Sure, absolutely.
But, you know, I think this is something that we want to talk about more in the weeks to come here on this radio program, which is going to be focusing on media. And if you stay with us, we're going to be right back. We're going to be talking about the Ukraine and hearing about a show taking place in the Lower East Side of Manhattan, which is raising questions about the media coverage of what's happening in the Ukraine. So stay with us here on Progressive Radio Network. Hey there, I'm Danny Schechter, your news dissector, here with Skip of MediaChannel.org, coming to us live from his news bunker somewhere in New York to share this conversation. We're going to have a little, hopefully, some interesting conversation now. We're going to be taking you directly to the actual dressing room of La Mama, the theater company in the Lower East Side, the theater in the Lower East Side, which has been, you know, world famous for experimental theater over the years, and also a stage where political ideas have been expressed. And joining us there is Bob Holman. Bob runs the Bowery Poetry Cafe, and he's now involved in a play talking in part about what's happening in the Ukraine. So, Bob, tell us a little bit more about what the play is and what's happening there, and introduce us to your fellow cast members.
Great, Danny. Standing right next to me is Verlana Koch, who's the director of the play. She heads the Yara Theater Group. That's a cultural connection between U.S., Ukraine, and many other countries. And Susan Wang, who's a musician and a comic. You may hear in the background the notes of Julian Katasti, who plays
a bandura, a traditional Ukrainian instrument.
And he's playing some of the dumi, the epic songs of Ukraine. This is the play is called Captain John Smith Goes to Ukraine. Everybody knows about Smith when he went to Virginia and met Pocahontas, but nobody knows that before that he actually was in Eastern Europe and spent time in Ukraine. He had an extraordinary epic life, was a slave, beheaded the Turks, became a captain in Transylvania, but it was in Ukraine where he really came in touch with the people other than his own culture and learned many of the lessons that he put into effect in Jamestown, and actually had the beginning of a sort of alternative U.S. going there.
So that's pretty interesting in itself, that there's a historical connection between the Ukraine and you know, America as we know it. Of
Can
course,
you believe it?
It's not in our history for the most part.
Not,
nobody knows
in,
anything about it.
It's in Smith's autobiography, which is the first autobiography ever published in English. And for years, historians thought that it was a bunch of dreamed-up fantasies. But it's lately been shown that much of it is true, and Verlana's visited the small towns over there where Smith was. He actually found a shipbuilder over there. Verlana?
Is that right?
Yeah. Right.
Well, before we get into that, just for a quick second, you know, this is a program on Progressive Radio Network that's really featuring on the media and the role of the media and what we don't know from the media about the rest of the world, which is a whole lot, and what we're not being told about what's happening in the Ukraine right now. So one of the reasons I wanted to reach out to you, Bob, is that you're dealing with a topic which, when you started it, may have seemed obscure, but which is extremely central right now to a global debate that's taking place about what's happening in the Ukraine and whether or not it could lead to a war, you know, between the superpowers and between the people of Ukraine and the people of Russia and the people of the United States. So this is a very topical, timely situation in this country. And as a cultural group of cultural workers, you're bringing it to people's attention, perhaps in a different way.
Well, you get it, Danny, because, you know, we were in Ukraine in September, and our friends with many of the people who've been in the Maidan and who continues to protest and put their lives on the line over there. Jordan, what's his
name? Serhiy Jordan, one of the great poets of Ukraine, really loved by everybody, and we've done his translations of two of his books, and we did, he performed at Bowery Poetry Club. He's a young guy in his 30s, and he was in Kharkiv. That's the town he's from, and they were part of the Maidan there, and a Russian trucked in mob came in and beat the hell out of them on March 1st.
So there's a lot that's going on. We use an epic from the early 1600s called Truth and Lies, which was written to point out the political situation then, that we have found it to be absolutely relevant to the truth and lies that we're going through right now. I think does open up a lens into the situation and get you into the interior of it in a way that the political analysis often misses. The cultural analysis is really extraordinary, Dan.
Well, Skip, you know, you raised with me, what are we going to talk with these people about? Well, there it is. Any thoughts?
Well, who's there?
This is my colleague in MediaChannel.org who's doing this program. This is our first program focusing on media.
Great. Congratulations.
So we're going off in a slightly different direction. We had a historian talking about the FBI in the first segment, and now we wanted to try to talk a little bit about Ukraine and what you're doing there at the La Mama Theater, and also what kind of response you're getting from the audience.
Well, people really love the piece. I mean, it is, you know, it starts off as a comedy and a very light sort of epic in an hour, and yet it raises really important issues. And the issue of truth and lies is certainly a central one by the end. And also, one of the interesting things that coincidentally, but not coincidentally, I mean, the people who are the, there's actually a third language involved in our show, and that's Crimean Tatar, because we've always worked with the Crimean Tatars, and in the Smith story, it's central because the person who captures Smith is actually Crimean Tatar poet.
And this is, of course, you know, everybody's talking about how Crimea now, as a matter of fact, even the New York Times has said the Russians are now in Crimea. They are set to invade Ukraine, completely forgetting that Crimea is as much part of Ukraine as Ohio is of the United States. But in Crimea, the minority, the Tatars,
which is the population, actually, is Crimean Tatar, not Russian. So it's,
who were sent by Stalin
to Siberia.
And when they returned, they claimed back Ukraine as their own land. So the situation, once you start looking beneath that veneer, this is part of Russia.
Or whatever, yeah.
Well, we've turned this into a U.S.-Russia conflict. You know, Putin.
But it's not about
Putin
that.
Is bad because Putin is invading a country. We, of course, never invade any country, so we're good. And that seems to be one of the subtexts here. We've been reading. A lot, and you know, and carrying a lot of stories about what's really behind all this, including natural gas, and you know, as one of the issues in this whole thing here, Skip.
Well, didn't they know that fracking is the way to save Ukraine, Danny?
Well, that's what people are saying now.
Yeah, that's amazing.
Yeah, or for that matter, that the Russian Minister of Interior said, well, the real reason for invading Ukraine was because they need labor Slavic labor out in Siberia, which is no longer Russian speaking.
So there are all these many layers to all of this. Is this getting through, do you think, in the press? Do you think the media is helping us understand what's going on, or, you know, do you think the media is distorting what's going on? In other words, reinforcing Cold War stereotypes?
I don't think there is one the media, you know. I mean, there's just as much distortion on as there is truth out there, and the question is sifting through it. I mean, I was shocked to hear some of the things Dr. Cohen was saying today on NPR, quite frankly, apologizing for Putin.
This Stephen Cohen of The Nation you're talking about?
Yeah, well, of NYU.
Okay. And so...
But I think there is, and this is an opportunity to, you know, you're down here on the Lower East Side, Danny, you scratch the surface and you're sitting in little Ukraine, you know, and to see the... shrine that's been built on Second Avenue for the Ukrainians who died at the Maidan. There's a way in which we here in New York can really are really part of what's going on there with the relationship. Where are your grandparents from, Danny?
Well, not from Belarus, maybe. You know,
yeah. Mine are from Ukraine. You know, so it's a lot. There's a lot of us down here.
But there's a lot, you know, amidst the nationalism, you know, that it seems to be evident on all sides here, there's also questions about, you know, were there fascist groups supporting these protests or trying to take them over? Are the Russians right to do what they're doing or not right to do what they're doing?
Oh, but fascist groups, I mean, quite frankly, the people who built, you know, beat the hell out of our friend, the poet Sidhija Dhan, on their own Facebook. Posed in fascist uniforms. So, who are the fascists here?
Skip, help me out here. What's your take?
everything I read seems like what we're dealing with is two diametrically opposed and perhaps irreconcilable viewpoints here. And I can't even make one, I can't even appraise one thing for another. I just see views that cater to political biases and confirm those biases. And I'd like to know, what are you hearing from the expat community that you interact with, and how would you broadly assess what's been transpiring over the couple of months? What is the objective truth as you see it as to what's transpiring?
Well, I mean, a lot of what we see actually is by looking on, you know, Hromadske TV, which is broadcasting live from the Maidan, et cetera, and, you know, which is in Ukrainian, of course, because that's where it's happening.
How do you see that now? How do you see it? Where do you see it?
Well, you see it online. There's four channels that are constantly broadcasting online.
And what is it called so people could go check it
They're
out?
They're called Hromadske TV, and Espresso TV is another one. And you can, you know, just watch online what's happening there. And, I mean, the commentary is all in Ukrainian, but you could also see it, you know. And there is... We know the people who are involved. These are not fascist people. These are artists. These are students. These are, you know, it was middle class women who stopped, you know, the police from storming, and grandmas from storming in St. Michael's Church.
So, again, I think the point that was just made was that there are, you know, seem to be different views of looking at this. There are people on the left who totally distrust the American government explanation of anything and everything, who see the Obama administration, you know, essentially playing power politics.
But this is not the filter we're getting our news from, you know.
So what are you seeing that we should be knowing, that if I can ask you that, that we're not getting in the New York Times or in alternative media?
What is really important is the fact that, you know, the people who are in Kiev, who you know, voted to change the Constitution, according to the Constitution, took over. This was not a coup at all, and that these were not backed by fascist nationalists, as often is said, but rather these were truly a popular resistance to an incredibly corrupt government, and that there are, to this day, I mean, today, there's huge amounts of troops that that are obviously Russian troops that Putin and others are just bald-faced lying about the fact that, that they're local. You know, they have license plates that are foreign. They have markings that are not right.
And we're talking about in the
what's happening in Crimea.
In Crimea,
it's like the Leon region, and it's like if somebody invaded Florida, would we be arguing about whether Florida, or you know, Mexico invaded Texas? Would we be arguing about whether Texas is really autonomous or not?
And point of fact, we did argue about that, and there are still people
who feel that. But today, would we be arguing about that?
No, but there are still people there who believe in the Texas Republic and blah, blah, blah.
Exactly that kind of insane conception you're dealing with.
Well, personally, I'm prepared to give Texas back to Mexico. If they would.
I'm with you on that.
I don't know what the people in Kiev feel.
So, do you guys have songs about the situation? Do you have poems about it?
Yeah.
Can you share some of it with us, possibly?
Yeah, here's Julian Katasti and his Bandura, and we'll see what we can do here.
Just. Well, this is
truth is nowhere to be found. Truth is waiting outside of the door while the liars are inside partying with the 1%.
Troops come into Crimea. Even the soldiers there aren't allowed to say what the truth is when they give up their guns. Have to say, okay, you guys can run the missiles for a while now.
Well, I'll just say that, you know, on this program, anything can happen, and it probably will. Okay? So
we hope, Jenny, that you'll take us up on our offer to come see the show.
Yeah, I mean,
there's a dialogue that comes out every night on these issues. We're running tonight through Sunday, and they're holding us over for 2 days next week now.
Well, what about the audience that's coming to this? Do you get into discussions with them, or are people finding information?
How does this audience differ from the usual audience that you get for Yara plays?
We always get a mix of people, you know, people from downtown community who go to experimental theater, people who like world music, people who like from the Ukrainian community.
Play is bilingual, Danny. Julian Ohm speaks Ukrainian in it, which is the way we did it when we were over in Ukraine in September. And then, of course, we do have the Crimean Tatar poem that's done here as well.
Well, you know, I mean, Clifford Odets, came up with this idea of the living newspaper, where people would actually enact the news or comment topically.
Right, the WPA.
On news developments.
Goes back to Russia in the 20s. What are you talking about?
Well, it goes back to Russia in the 20s, I'm sure.
Meyer holding those guys. That's who was doing it way earlier.
But my point about it is that we need cultural commentary on these issues to give it a more than a one-dimensional approach, you know, just like you're for Putin, you're against Putin, you're for... I mean, we want to try to recognize that there are actual people living here, not just, you know, populations, not just, you know, fascists or what other label that you might want to throw onto all of this, and hear what they're actually saying and doing. That doesn't really come over very well, except to report on, you know, incidents that leave people dead in the streets. We don't know why they're in the streets to begin with in many cases.
Well, we certainly know why the Crimean Tatars were demonstrating in front of the UN saying Crimea is part of Ukraine. It is because, you know, it is the Russian population. Well, it was, you know, the Stalin government that deported them. That's why they don't particularly want to go back to that place.
Yeah, you can't blame them for that. I think it's a complicated mosaic, and it's also an issue that has divided the world now. We don't know, Obama is making very, you know, strident comments. He wants to put Russia under sanctions, Russian officials under sanctions, and the rest of it, sanctions which really haven't worked in many other places. But nevertheless, that seems
so
to be...
So then they're not strident comments. I mean, you know, it hasn't worked. Then something else must be
But
done.
I'm saying, I mean, there has to be some sort of negotiated approach to this, and so far that hasn't really gotten off the ground, has it?
It would be great if Ukraine and Russia could be in the same room together, even.
Yeah, at this point that doesn't seem to be happening, but you're getting, by watching what you're watching from Ukraine, the television there, and you, some of you speak Ukrainian, what's the message that's coming across from the Ukrainian side?
Well, they're just totally stunned and outraged and surprised that they are waiting for everybody to hear the truth. And that's why they've invited the press to come to Kiev to say, look, nobody's fascist here. You know, what is going on? It's actually Crimea that's blocked the observers. And Crimea that's blocked, or the Russians in Crimea that have blocked the newspapers from coming.
And what you get from the... from people in Kiev especially and other cities, it's just this tremendous sense of wanting to be very inclusive. There have been a lot of demonstrations in recent days in exactly those large eastern and southern cities, in Odessa and Donetsk. that have where people of all kinds, by no means only Ukrainian speaking, a lot of Russian speakers have come out to support the idea of Ukraine as an inclusive country,
right? And
for all of its people.
And there was a big petition signed by the Jewish leaders of the Jewish various Jewish communities, saying to Putin, saying that we are considered one of the Russian-speaking parts of Ukrainian population, yet we do not support your policy here.
So,
and you're not doing it in our name. There was a huge petition about it.
Well,
signed by all the major rabbis, all the major cultural figures. It was just out yesterday, I saw it.
Well, this is an issue that I think we're going to see continued and grow even more intense, you know, as various people weigh in on this, you know, the EU, the United States, the people of the Ukraine, and people around the world, many of whom do not want to see, you know, a Russian invasion or intervention there. There's been a whole dispute within the RT network, where an anchor woman there has resigned, protesting against the coverage. At the same time, another anchor who also criticized the coverage, Abby Martin, has gone on CNN you know, basically criticized the attitude there, which was, you know, like the American media is great and glorious. The American media tells the truth and nobody else does. And she took that on and challenged it. So these are issues that are coming right into our own newsrooms. And that's why we need something like Media Channel to monitor some of this coverage and to try to offer different perspectives, including yours. Okay. Because I think the cultural perspective here is very important. Bob, have you written a poem about this that we can go out on, or do you have some thoughts?
You know, what we're doing here is, let me just read a little bit of the translation of Truth and Lies as we worked on it.
Tick, tick, tick.
Lies, lies, lies. I write the truth, they call it lies. They call it amnesty, they throw us in jail anyway. But my favorite lie has got to be, I'm telling you the truth. Truth is in the song. Truth is in the singer's voice. They came from hundreds of years ago, passed on voice to voice, poet to poet, Bandura to Bandura. How do we translate it? Read today's headlines. Listen to today's speaker. Understand the meaning of truth that holds to itself.
Skip, final thought.
100,000 voices speaking, and 100,000 people in the Maidan speaking through one voice of truth.
Well, that's very powerful, Bob Holman. Thank you so much, and thank you to your fellow cast members. Chaotic as this may have been with distorted audio and the rest, we get the spirit of your desire to put this out in a way that's culturally relevant to what's happening there and certainly offers a perspective that we haven't heard very much as in a sense, the big power debate seems to take precedence in the left media as well as in the right media. Any final thoughts here? Skip briefly, because we're about to move out.
Well, truth be told, I just want to tell people Yanukovych leaks after the president fled his residence. Young journalist jumped into his pond, pulled out a whole bunch of records that really substantiate the corruption of his government, from what I understand. But my real concern is that there's another side, a competing section of oligarchs who are now potentially going to come to power and really replicate that corruption. And real quickly, if I can ask our guests, how do you appraise the opposition, that political leadership, and are we going to get Yanukovych just friendly to the West, just to compete?
We just have 20 seconds now. We need a quick comment.
20 seconds, scratch down.
Yeah, making a new world, and you have to do it every day, one step at a time, and that's, I think, I believe that that is what people are trying to do.
Well, people, if you live in New York City, go to La Mama and check out this show about Captain John Smith and the Ukraine. It's fascinating. We've been listening to some of it and talking with the people behind it. It's just one of the many features that we hope to offer, features like this, on future programs here on News Dissector Radio. You'll be able to read more about this on MediaChannel.org, as well as we'll have the podcast there as well. Check out the site and help us if you can by with support and with ideas and suggestions. Thank you very much for listening. I'm Danny Schechter, your News Dissector. We'll be back next week.
Bye-bye love, bye-bye happiness.